Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When wildfires happen in California, the most important thing we think about is protecting life and then property. Everything else comes after. And while we've been lucky so far this summer, over the years, as our climate has changed, our fire behavior has intensified, the damage from wildfires and lingering hazardous smoke is also impacting California's agricultural industry. And that includes wine. According to the California Wine Institute, our state produces over 80% of wine in the United States. That amounts to a $170 billion in economic activity. But smoke from wildfires can, and they do, impact the quality of wine we produce. Researchers are working to find solutions to protect our wine industry, but they need to develop them in ways that won't damage the environment and increase costs to an unsustainable level. CAP Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida joins us with what she's learned. Good morning, Manola. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
So let's just start with the basics. What is smoke taint and how does it impact wine?
Basically, when a wildfire happens and smoke settles over a vineyard, the grapes somehow take on that flavor. So I talked to some researchers to learn a little bit more about that process. One of them was Carrie Wilkinson, a wine researcher with the University of Adelaide in Australia. She told me we understand parts of the process, but the actual answer to this question isn't really clear yet.
I would argue that maybe the jury is still out on that. So my feeling is that, you know, when smoke drifts into the vineyard, the volatile compounds that are present in the smoke are just being directly absorbed into the berry. They're certainly being taken up by the leaves.
And that's her guess at that. So it's, like I said, not totally clear. But what I've been looking at through this story is that if you taste the smoke-tainted grapes straight off the vine, you might not notice a difference. But after they're processed into wine and the flavors are condensed, that's when you'll notice that they've been tainted by smoke. So what that does is it ruins the taste of the wine. It makes it really smoky. And as a result of all the big fires we've seen in California in recent years, it's had this huge impact on the wine industry. After fires in 2020, the California Association of Wine Grape Growers estimated that up to 325,000 tons of grapes weren't usable. And that led to about $3 billion in losses. So of course, that has really huge impacts.
Yeah, and a lot of people whose jobs are tied up in that. I mean, when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of tons of grapes, billions of dollars that have been lost, I mean, I imagine, unfortunately, there's a pretty good understanding of what exactly it tastes like. What does smoke taint taste like in a glass of wine?
Yeah, most of the researchers I talked to said it was kind of like an ashtray flavor. So really smoky aftertaste. It's kind of stale as well. It kind of builds with each sip. The researchers I talked to said that, interestingly, not everyone is, you know, finds this wine as distasteful. Some can actually enjoy it. But they did say that after a certain level of smoke taint, you know, that number might become fewer, that it might be hard to enjoy for anyone. I had a chance to try it myself. One of the researchers with UC Davis gave me some wine that they'd made from grapes that had been tainted by smoke in Sonoma during the 2020 fires. And I'll say personally, I didn't really love the flavor. Like I said, it's kind of stale. You might think smoky like barbecue, that's not so bad. But I would also say that it's a little bit stale. And then I also had the chance to give this wine to some of my coworkers, our coworkers, and get some reactions, which paint a pretty good picture of what it tastes like.
If you gave me this at a barbecue place or maybe a backyard cookout where we're eating barbecue and this was the wine on the table, I'd have a glass.
A strong aftertaste of smoke, like kind of like when the air is smoky and like after a wildfire and you can kind of like almost taste it on the back of your mouth. Like I almost can taste that.
Tastes a little more sour than what I'm used to. It's not unpleasant, but it's definitely different. Kind of like, when you first have a sour beer, it takes you by surprise at first.
And then I had a friend also try the wine after I brought it home, and I felt like their reaction was a pretty good summary.
It tastes like fire season, like wildfire season.
So, understandably, tainted wine is kind of hard to get your hands on just because a lot of wineries don't want to be associated with it in any way. So I feel kind of lucky that I got to try it, but at the same time, it was, you know, it wasn't great.
Yeah. And when it comes to smoke taint, I mean, obviously, we've had increasingly devastating, destructive, and deadly wildfires in the last 5 to 6 years. But when it comes to smoke taint and how it specifically affects wine grapes and just overall a glass of wine and bottles of wine, when did smoke taint first get on the radar?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So research on smoke taint is pretty new, and I think a lot of the research that we have to do about longer-term impacts of wildfires and what that means for, you know, our society, for California as a whole, that's something that researchers are still working on. The first academic paper about this specific topic came out of Australia about 2 decades ago. That's why I talked to Carrie, that Australian researcher. She was one of the first people to research this. And at the time, when she first was studying this, she told me that she wasn't really sure it would be such a big deal. She kind of thought it was something that, you know, was maybe more of a freak accident.
I think it was 2002 or 2003 when there was the first fire event, and the Australian Wine Research Institute did some preliminary studies and suggested that, yes, there could be some impact from smoke. And I think everyone kind of thought it's going to be a one-off. So that was sort of it.
Obviously, a lot has changed since then. And in California, you know, there were some smaller instances of this happening as well, but it wasn't until 2018 and 2020 and the big fires we saw those years that the wine industry and, you know, officials as well, state officials, really started to see how serious of a problem this was.
What did you learn from winemakers in California when you talked to them about how they've been impacted in recent years?
Yeah, it's been a huge impact, not surprisingly. Another side note is that I did reach out to a lot of winemakers that just weren't interested in talking because, like I said, they are really nervous about being associated with this. But I did get a chance to talk to a winemaker, a small winemaker, who has a vineyard in Mendocino County, Navarro Vineyards. One of the owners, it's a couple, Deb Kahn, talked with me about running the smaller vineyard that they have and how their first experience with smoke taint came much earlier than 2018. I think it was around 2008. And at the time, like I mentioned, it was just not something that people really knew about. They only realized that their wine was tainted at all after they'd already sent it out to people that had subscribed for some like early release wine. And when they realized that, they told these people, okay, you can keep this at a discount or you can send it back depending on whether or not you like it. Some people, kind of as a novelty, thought it was cool and did keep it, but a lot of people did send it back. And that was just their first taste of this problem. And since then, Deb, the owner, told me that they've been pretty lucky. Their own grapes have not been impacted. But since they're a small vineyard, a lot of small winemakers like themselves will also source grapes from other parts of California. And that's where the problem has been, that when they're trying to get grapes from grape growers that they've had a relationship with for a long time, suddenly now they're having to deal with this concern that those grape growers are impacted by smoke.
And if there's a problem, we don't take the grapes. And, you know, it's tough to tell that to a longtime grower because they spent a lot of time and effort growing their crop. So, you know, what's hard about it is during the regular growing season, everything looks fine. And then it's not usually until late in the season when things are dry when you have the problem with the smoke.
And that obviously has a bigger impact too. Deb told me that a lot of grape growers that she's worked with for a really long time, some of them have actually decided to, you know, step out of the industry because the financial hits were just too difficult to deal with.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with CAP Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida about research trials to reduce smoke taint from wildfires that's impacting California's wine industry. Okay, so you actually had time to spend and learn from these researchers while they're out doing a trial. What are they testing out exactly?
I did. I went to Davis and I spent some time with researchers and vineyards they've cultivated there specifically for test trials. And testing out different solutions. The trial that I saw was one where they were testing a couple different sprays to see if they might protect the grapes from absorbing smoke, you know, before the smoke hits. The sprays that were used that day are sprays that are actually already on the market, but for different uses. One of them, for example, was one that's used for mold at the moment. So what happens is that the manufacturers of sprays like that start to wonder if they also might be helpful in preventing smoke taint too. So sometimes they'll offer their sprays to these researchers and say, hey, can you test this out for us? Because obviously, if that's something that they can market, they want to be able to do that. One of the lead researchers I spoke to and one who led these trials is Anita Overholster. She told me that often these sprays aren't going to be the perfect barrier. And actually, under normal field conditions, they actually really offer only about 10% protection for the grapes. But what she's interested in is finding any solution, even solutions that only help a little bit. So they're testing these sprays to see if they have any effect at all.
It's going to be very hard to find a solution in the vineyard that's going to prevent, that's very practical and not too expensive, that's going to prevent absorption of volatile phenols that's in smoke onto grapes. It will be very valuable to get a treatment option that is not too expensive and can actually treat wine and not impact the overall quality greatly, so that that wine can actually be sold. And perhaps sold in the bracket it was aimed for originally.
Right now, sprays don't really seem like the answer. Anita told me that the solutions with bigger impacts might actually be looking at the grapes after they've already been made into wine. And one of those methods to reduce taint from wine is reverse osmosis. So that's just one example. But right now, even those approaches have some pretty big issues too.
They reduce the aroma intensity of the wines. They reduce some of the body of the wines. And that's a negative. So after treatment, those wines can't go into the price bracket it was aimed for. It needs to go into a much lower label or, you know, doesn't get sold at all because, you know, some people have really no quality margin to speak of because they have one label that they sell at a high price point. So any impact is the sentence of death. They can't sell their wines. So if we can come up with a solution that can target only the compounds that's problematic and remove them and leave everything else alone, that would be huge. You know, and you know, perhaps it won't be 100%, but if we can get 90 to 80%, that's good enough.
So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. Anita sees these trials, though, as still being really useful in one, making sure that no company is misrepresenting what their product can do. And also, they've learned some best practices for grape growers along the way. So, for example, Anita was telling me that if you spray the grapes right before smoke hits, that actually might help the grapes absorb the smoke and make for even worse flavor. So there needs to be kind of a drying period. So for that reason, there is some help from these trials in that they're making sure that grape growers aren't making the problem worse for themselves and that they're really figuring out some best practices that could help protect their crop just a little bit.
Yeah, so I'm learning from you. There isn't like a silver bullet. There's going to be a range of incremental solutions to help curb this problem. So what does the future look like for this research?
Anita said she's feeling pretty hopeful that they'll have a better solution in the next couple years, one that actually might not degrade the wine quality as much as the current ones do. And I think on the plus side as well, there's just been so much funding for this research since 2018, since 2020. Anita and many of the other researchers I talked to all said that, yeah, there's just been a lot more support now, which really helps them in finding those solutions. You know, just as recently as last week, California Representative Mike Thompson presented the UC Davis research team, which includes Anita, a $1.2 million check specifically for this smoke exposure research. So, you know, like I mentioned, there's just a lot of interest right now. And it's just kind of part of this conversation we're having about how wildfires are just changing California. And, you know, how do we come to understand that? And, yeah.
There's a need and also the political will to do something about it.
Definitely. And I mean, the wine industry is such a huge part of how we even understand California's identity. So it makes sense that this is something people are worried about.
Manola, thanks for the reporting.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Cap Radio environment reporter Manola Sakaida sharing her reporting about research trials to reduce smoke taint from wildfires that's impacting California's wine industry. Up next, a Sacramento nonprofit is helping entrepreneurs succeed in opening their own storefront. We'll get a look at the business incubation program called Culture Club. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The city of Sacramento is home to more than 20,000 businesses, and roughly 70% are considered small businesses with 50 employees or less. If you walk down pretty much any street, you can see they are fundamental to the local economy. But it's not for the faint of heart. Getting a business off the ground, overcoming risk, becoming successful can be tough to do alone, especially when you take on the added overhead of having a storefront. A new nonprofit wants to make those hurdles less daunting for local entrepreneurs. Culture Club is located in the heart of Midtown Sacramento and is described as a business incubation program, as well as a co-working space and the site of pop-up events. The founder is Rashawn Davis, and he joins us with more about Culture Club's mission. Good morning, Rashawn. Thanks for making the trip. So before we get into Culture Club, we got to start with what got you to this point. So let's start with your background, the learning lessons that you've had in Sacramento that really led to your nonprofit work.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've been an entrepreneur now for 16 years, you know, and being an entrepreneur in Sacramento comes with its challenges, but it also comes with its successes, right? And so this was kind of like our ode, our legacy to giving that information and those, you know, we bumped our heads a lot as entrepreneurs in this business and growing in this space. We've learned a lot of lessons. We met a lot of people. We've made a lot of connections. And so with culture, you know, it's like giving that over to the younger generation or folks who are aspiring to be that, to kind of remove those barriers and hurdles that come just with naturally entrepreneurship.
Yeah, taking those hard learning lessons that you experience and paying it forward and helping reduce that for a younger generation. What are some of the challenges that you experienced when it came to not only building a career, but investing in yourself in Sacramento?
You know, one of the things that people always say you should first do is get an accountant when you're an entrepreneur. And when you're a young entrepreneur, that does not make sense until you get to a point where your business starts making money and then you start having to hire bookkeepers and tax consultants, all of those things, and you get yourself into a lot of tax debt and things like that. That is my story. You know, had a accountant that just had gotten from someone, maybe it was like an ad or something, didn't know how to check them or anything like that. Come to find out, he had doubled, like, billed our taxes or no, our expenses and all of those things. And so we had this big tax debt. And I was like, this doesn't seem right. But I didn't know the language to say, like, you did this wrong. And so then I met with our now accountant, Jill Jacobs, and I had to go back 3 years of taxes to, like, undo what this person had done just because, you know, he wanted the money at the end of the day. You know, he didn't sit down with us and tell us about, like, these different things. And so it's so important, like, these basics for entrepreneurs, especially creative entrepreneurs, who we just get into business because we love doing what we do.
You're passionate.
Passion will lead you to making something and then meeting people and telling them, you know, them telling you that you should do this as a business. Mm-hmm. And then you get the idea of, like, yeah, let's do this as a business. But there's still, like, this technical side of business, technical side of entrepreneurship that we're trying to teach creative people. So then that way they're more equipped when they're going into the business field.
Yeah, like, you have the passion, you have the drive, you have the talent, but there isn't really this handbook that you're given about, especially when it comes to financial literacy and knowing how to navigate owning your own business and making it successful, which brings me to Culture Club. What is the mission of Culture Club to help alleviate these challenges?
Yeah, Culture Club right now, it's a pilot program that we have in partnership with CADA, which is the Capital Area Development Authority. It's a City of Sacramento and State of California joint partnership. And, you know, it was just this pilot program to say, like, hey, if we really want to invest in our local entrepreneurs, if we want to see, like, our corridors thriving with small businesses and not these big box stores, we have to invest in them. And so, you know, CADA had this building that was an enterprise for years and years and years on the corner of 16th and N. And, you know, they said, what can we do? And so we said, let's make it into an incubator and let's teach 9 entrepreneurs the ropes of brick and mortar. And let's get them in this world of, like, hey, these are the things that you have to learn as you're going along, especially when you open up a brick and mortar mm-hmm. space, which is different. A lot of creatives do the markets, and there's a now, especially in this market of Sacramento, there's a lot of markets that go on, but those are like 5-6 hour events, right? And so we've seen over the years, like people go from like these 5-6 hour events to then trying to open a store. And it's a totally different beast. It has different hours and time commitments and overhead and staffing and all of these different things, but there's not like a bridge. Mm-hmm. And so with Culture Club, it's like, let's do this for 6 months and build out this pilot program. And hopefully, you know, the goal is to continue this. And maybe we do it in different areas, in different spaces, and then really focus on neighborhoods as we have multiple culture clubs that then entrepreneurs can learn. And then the goal, obviously, is for them to then graduate from the program and be able to either save up enough money or have enough technical experience for them to open up their own brick and mortar next door or somewhere on the corridor as well.
What is the state of brick and mortar businesses, like mom and pop storefronts in communities, especially when there is the threat of it becoming obsolete with online shopping and digital marketplaces? Where do they fit into retail?
It's such an important piece of a neighborhood, right? Like when you close your eyes and you picture a neighborhood and you picture a bustling neighborhood, it is filled with coffee shops and bakeries
and
stores, and not just one retail store, but multiple. So you can find trinkets and, you know, gifts and things like that. That is truly like what makes a neighborhood, you know? And so that only exists if there's mom and pop businesses along those spaces to like really enhance that, you know? And so it's such an important piece, but it's such an overlooked piece because, you know, I think for the majority of us, right, like when we're walking in these places that we love, we don't think about all the things that the entrepreneur has to think about or the small business owner has to think about, is like how to keep your doors open and, you know, how to make mm-hmm. the books balance and hiring and firing. And so there's so many different things that go into when you walk down a street and you see all of these small businesses that we're just trying to shed light on and strengthen in our local economy, right? Because there's a lot of like great local entrepreneurs that have the chops to be a small business, but, you know, it comes with help and assistance. And, you know, there's so many different ways to support that we're looking for. It's not just, yeah, one is, yeah, go support them and shop from them. But there's a whole back end that a lot of people don't see that we're trying to help with.
Yeah, like on the front end, we as customers may not really appreciate or understand all the work that goes into getting a small business opened, but we do feel it when those businesses shutter.
Yeah.
And they're vacant, and you see vacant storefronts in areas where you love to walk around because it adds that beloved texture and character to a community. So when it comes to Culture Club, you're right in the heart of Midtown Sacramento. You mentioned it used to be a former Enterprise car rental, and now it's been completely transformed. Help us visualize what it's like.
Yeah, so when you walk in, you know, you walk in the front door and, you know, Kata did a great job of like activating the outside area. So, you know, we have murals on both sides of the walls, you know, so when you pull up or you pass it, it's just this beautiful visual space. And then we transformed this old parking lot into an outdoor seating area. So it's just an eye-grabbing, attention-getting space just walking past, right? And so, you know, we see it a lot. People walk past and they'll look and they'll pull out their phones and take pictures, you know, and so that's part of it. And then when you walk in, there's different, like, shops. So there's 9 different areas in there, and so it ranges from vintage clothing to coffee to kava to, you know, home care things. And so it's just this space, you know, that is, it's magical. Like when you walk in, especially, you know, the funniest thing is when you've been in it before, you know, a lot of us in Sacramento have rented a car from Enterprise in that space. And you're like, wait, this, and we get it all the time. People are like, yeah, this was the Enterprise. I stood right here, you know, but we just transformed the space because that's part of like what we do too, is like giving the end user like this beautiful experience and this memorable experience to like really go into the space and feel the magic. And then the folks that are there, the entrepreneurs are there, are greeting you and saying, hey, come try this kava, you know, come try a latte over here, you know. So it's just this vibe that it's unmatchable, you know.
And it's open daily.
Daily, yep.
Mm-hmm. And especially the outdoor space. I mean, you can pick up some lunch and then go eat outside. And then you also have pop-up events as well.
Yep. Yeah. There's all that, you know, and we try and activate the space because, you know, especially on corridors that there's not a lot of foot traffic, you have to create ways to bring people in, you know. So having that space there is a good test of, like, when you throw events and you invite the community in, community shows up. And so, you know, people have used it for so many different reasons. Like, I haven't even, like, we didn't fathom all the uses, but it's been like a songwriting circle space. So if you write songs, you can sit in the circle. There's a poetry, there's tea and poetry, there's silent disco, you know, there's modeling casting calls. There's been so many different things that the community have used it for, which then goes to show another part, which is like this community gathering space is really important in neighborhoods too, you know. So,
and it's interconnected to a business becoming successful. It's like a symbiotic relationship. It's not just like you just need the business, you need the culture and the community as well to invest in it.
Yep. And then, you know, the people who come into the doors are, you know, again, they get to meet, you know, all of the entrepreneurs and develop a rapport with them. And then they end up coming back and then they shop again and then they support again. And then it just becomes the cycle of this experience that folks have. So
you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Rashawn Davis, founder of the nonprofit Culture Club, a pilot business incubator program which helps Sacramento entrepreneurs start their own business and their storefront, as well as hosting community pop-up events in Midtown. So how does the membership work for the 9 entrepreneurs who are currently part of Culture Club? How is it different from going at it alone?
So I think the main difference is you have support, right? You're going in it with a cohort first and foremost. And, you know, I always say, especially in the entrepreneur world, you know, it really is like two heads are better than one, you know. So some folks might be good at like social media and then they're picking up that. Some folks might be good at just making sure the space is maintained and they're picking up that. So you can kind of lean on other people's strengths and, you know, you have your weaknesses and kind of go back and forth. So I think that works well. I think just the learning settings too, you know, we have mentor sessions with folks. And so when you're in a group with like someone who has had a brick and mortar for 20 years and you're learning, maybe somebody asks a question that you weren't thinking of. And so we see that too. So we have like monthly mentor sessions where we invite someone from the community in who's been in that space and they tell their story and they tell, you know, what they've been through, successful or non-successful, you know. And then just the questions that come up, it's like, oh, whoa, I would have never asked that question, but that's a great question. So I think you get that as well. But then you also have shared cost, right? So everybody isn't paying like just their own, you know, rent and all of those things. It's like shared. So everyone shares the utilities. And then through the partnership with CADA, they pay 5% of whatever they make each month into Culture. So,
and I would imagine that's significantly different than if they were to open their own storefront and pay all the overhead and rent for that.
100%. Yeah.
When it comes to the individuals like these 9 entrepreneurs who are part of it, you had the grand opening earlier this summer, I believe in May or June. So you're a couple months in. What kind of feedback have you received from them so far?
Oh, it's been amazing. You know, like we're seeing the, you know, I'm entrepreneur at heart, you know, creative too, but entrepreneur as well, right? So you're seeing like the transactions. That's what I look at, you know. So you're seeing like folks that are having over 200 transactions in 1 month, you know, with average sales of like $17 and things like that. And so when you're looking at the math of it and like the actual data of it, you're like, yeah, we're really making an impact. And that's just one of the 9 businesses. And so like that's been one of the things that I've been looking at more and more is like there's real data here that shows that this model works, you know. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, it's always good for the entrepreneurs that are there. They're like, yo, I made some money this month. Like, this is great. Like, I'm just starting out, or I didn't have a brick and mortar before and I wasn't making money. And so, you know, I always look at those things to kind of move the needle. But then also, you know, just the people that have come through the door and the community folks that have reached out to like want to be a part of it and support it is just amazing.
Is there an end to this pilot program? Is it 1 year? When do these entrepreneurs decide whether they're ready to start their own storefront or maybe go, you know, go at it a different way.
Yeah, so that's still up in the air. You know, it does come down to funding and support, you know, to keep the overhead lower. We do need support. But it's been interesting to see the range of, like, response. We have someone in there who's 21, who just turned 21, and she's just trying to figure out, like, what she's doing, you know. And then we have folks that have just been a year in their business, and they're like, okay, like, if this is the ropes of, like, what I have to do, maybe I need to pivot my model. Mm-hmm. And so it's this safe space to get uncomfortable and have uncomfortable conversations and uncomfortable expression of self to, like, really then decide, okay, I do want this to be my brick and mortar. Or it's like, actually, nah, I want to switch it up and maybe I do want to go online. Either way, you know, we're kind of figuring out which way that folks want to go, and it's a safe space to do so.
Yeah, it's like a buffer trial and error without potentially running into devastating consequences that impacts your future. This is just one piece of what you're doing in Sacramento. You have a 2040 plan to shift the cultural landscape. What does that look like to you?
Yeah, you know, it's to shift the cultural landscape, I think it's just putting folks at the table. You know, I think Sacramento has a beautiful culture here already, you know, and it's just about collaboration and making sure that we're all working on the same page, you know. So that comes directly from the city's general plan. You know, the general plan is for 2040. So what we've been doing is, like, shifting to work alongside the city to say, like, okay, if you have a general plan that you're working off of, how do we infuse culture into it? How do we infuse what's already happening in today into this general plan, right? Because I feel like a lot of times, especially, like, people of culture, we don't have the foresight to think to 2040. We're just trying to get through the day, you know? And so the more and more that we can build up our capacity to shift along with the city, by 2040, it'll be a beautiful space because we're all at the table. And that's the goal.
And you have other projects in addition to helping, you know, entrepreneurs open up their storefront. I mean, you have worked in creating revitalization in communities without displacement, the power of learning equity in home ownership, helping people, especially first-time home buyers, get that first home. You focus on wellness, you know. You have a lot of projects going on in Sacramento. So come 2040, if you had a crystal ball and you see Sacramento, what does success look like to you when it comes to all the interconnectedness of what makes culture and making Sacramento successful for everybody?
Yeah, we always say, like, it's an integrated community, you know, like, that is the vision that we're going for, where you have local entrepreneurs that can have an idea, have a safe space to grow that idea, and then plant that idea here. And not only just with their idea, but also with their business, with their home, and then also in that neighborhood, you know. And so when we can get to that integrated level of community development, that's when I know, like, all right, we've done what we came to do.
Finally, Rashawn, you said that you're 16 years in of these hard learning lessons, helping others navigate them more gracefully. Why do you still believe in Sacramento and this is the place to do it?
You know, I'm a firm believer, and you are where you are, and you're supposed to be where you are, you know. And so being here and learning all these lessons, I think Sacramento is a beautiful canvas for creative entrepreneurs, right? Like, we have a good space, blank space, where we don't have to compete on a level like San Francisco or LA or New York. It's like we have this beautiful space that we can kind of create, you know, and then develop our chops. And you see it all the time. Like, there are so many different people from Sacramento that go on and do, like, amazing things in other industries and other cities. And it's like, that's because Sacramento is such a beautiful breeding ground for creativity.
Well, thank you for being part of it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Rashawn Davis is the founder of the nonprofit Culture Club, a pilot business incubator program which helps Sacramento entrepreneurs start their own brick and mortar businesses, as well as hosting community workspace and pop-up events in Midtown Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As you might be aware, Insight was off for a summer break, and we are returning during a tough time for CAP Radio. Last week, beloved coworkers, friends, and voices on the radio were laid off, along with the cancellation of four Saturday music programs that have been on the air for years and in some cases, decades. The programs are Mick Martin's Blues Party, Hey Listen, KZAP, and At the Opera. The layoffs impacted both Cap Radio and North State Public Radio, which Cap Radio operates and is based in Chico. And these decisions are due to ongoing financial issues. Because we are a newsroom, we're going to report on what's happening with transparency and with listeners in mind. To get a better understanding of the challenges facing Cap Radio and the cuts that were made, we're joined by Cap Radio Interim General Manager Tom Carlo. And a note, following NPR's protocol for reporting on itself, no Cap Radio corporate official or news executive reviewed this segment before broadcast. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Vicky.
Well, I want to begin by making clear that you're new to Cap Radio. You were brought on as interim general manager less than a month ago. I think you're going on your third week now. You actually came out of retirement after spending nearly 50 years at KPBS. That's the PBS and NPR station in San Diego. So let's start with your background and why that made you a good fit to take on these challenges.
Well, public media has been my career for almost 50 years at KPBS in San Diego. It is the public broadcasting stations as PBS and NPR. We are what's called the joint licensee, but we're also licensed to San Diego State University. So there's a lot of similarities in Cap Radio and Sacramento State University. The last 12 years of my career, I was the general manager, where we made a significant move to converge TV into radio into one media content producing organization. Our people didn't think of us as a TV business or a radio business. We were a media organization, and we focused on serious local news. Plus, we had a classical stream that we had, and I think we were quite successful. I retired in 2020 as general manager, and we were at that time about a $38 million organization with almost 190 employees. Our radio station was consistently number one in the marketplace, and I retired, and I started splitting my time in Lake Tahoe, where I became a fan of Cap Radio. And I was given a call in the middle of July as I was enjoying my retirement. And it was from President Luke Wood of Sacramento State, who was a colleague of mine at San Diego State. And he said, we have some financial issues. I know you're not looking for coming out of retirement, but you could you come down and help us? You've done this before. I've gone through major financial downfalls in my previous job. And we had to figure out a way to rebound it, because at the end of the day, we have to be good stewards of our finances. And Cap Radio has some significant financial problems. And I was brought in to see if I could stabilize the organization, find that level playing field, and begin to hit a reset button, and then rebuild. Let a new incoming president and general manager take us to another level. Mm-hmm.
Layoffs are never easy. And the layoffs last Wednesday, they felt abrupt, both to staff, but also to listeners as well. What do you want listeners to know about these financial challenges and why these cuts had to be made?
Well, the finances are pretty severe right now for Cap Radio. We owe a lot of money to vendors right now. And we barely have enough cash to keep us going right now. We are making payroll. And it's just been a very, very tough time. We have no reserves. And it was time to make some serious, serious decisions. No matter what the decision was, you're talking about, you mentioned the music shows. If we would have cut Insight or cut local news, it would have been the same outpour, because people love Cap Radio. You never make a programming decision without a group of vocal people telling you, why did you take my show away? So this was almost a no-win situation for us in our decision-making. But we had to look at things from a 50,000-foot level, and we had to look at what are we going to do? This was not done just in isolation by me. Our board, our executive committee, has been working months, really, when we started to discover that there were some financial issues a few months ago. And so we had to make a decision, and this was the decision we made. I know people are upset about it, but you know what? Cap Radio is bigger than all of us, and we need to go forward with really trying our best to grow both the news station and the classical music station.
Of the layoffs, 9 were at Cap Radio, but 3 were also at North State Public Radio, NSPR, which is based in Chico, and an additional 3 employees were given a final employment date. So that makes a total of 15 employees that are being let go out of a staff of just over 100. And that doesn't include existing staff vacancies that won't be filled for the foreseeable future due to these financial challenges. How did you and the board, if you can walk us through a little bit, how you decided where to make cuts?
Well, I don't think it's I don't really want to get into the nitty gritty on that, because when you're dealing with that, you're dealing with personnel decisions and people. And part of us is that part of our decision was not to be out in the, you know, going out front with who is going to be cut or what are we going to be cut. The best thing we could do is try to say, how could we keep the basic service of the news and information station 90.9 and the classical music station going in a way that allows us to rebuild those in the future. Again, as I've said to some of the members of the staff, no matter what show we would have cut, you'd be here asking the different questions. So for us, it was a matter of how do we get us back to a balanced budget? How do we get a plan in place to pay back some loans that we have, to pay back all the vendors that we haven't paid, and to stabilize what I think is a drastically changing media environment. And let me say, too, we're not unique to this here. NPR has just gone through its second major layoff, the biggest public radio station in the state, the former KPCC in Los Angeles, LAist, has now laid off people. Newspapers are cutting back dramatically. Traditional media, radio, television, and print is in a declining marketplace because digital is starting to take audiences away. And one of the reasons I want us to hit the reset button is to start thinking about us being more than a radio station. We really need to take a digital-first approach with our content, because younger audiences, 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds, and even the 40-year-olds are not listening to radio the way my generation started listening to it. And if we don't start looking at those audiences, you know, I think that we'll continue to see a decline, because we have seen a decline in audience. I was actually amazed to see the numbers that showed a significant drop in audience on Cap Radio. It is really amazing. Now, radio is losing audiences around the country, especially the NPR affiliates, but Cap Radio has lost a lot of audience. We have to stop that. We have to figure out how do we retain the audiences we have and really go to a digital-first approach. So a reset button is, I think, a good way of saying is what we're trying to do right now. And we want to focus on our 2 main platforms, our classical music station and our news and information station. And let's rethink a new vision for the future. And what I want to do, too, is lay a nice foundation for the next president and general manager, that he or she will come in and be able to have a baseline to go forward in this new era. Because, as I said, I came in to help Cap Radio. Cap Radio has got a terrific brand. It is something that my wife and I, we split our time in San Diego and in Lake Tahoe. I always listen to Cap Radio. It was kind of a thrill to get a chance to meet you last week, Vicki, because you have star quality for me. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that our Cap Radio would preserve in this environment, because it's valuable, not just to Sacramento, Northern California. Cap Radio is very valuable to the entire state of California. When I was running KPBS in San Diego, we used Cap Radio stories all the time. It was how I informed our local audience in the San Diego region of what was happening in the Capitol. So I'm here to help the organization, not tear it down.
Yeah. And I understand, on the one hand, you have this challenge of helping Cap Radio grow, and you talk about, you know, really going into digital, but you also have longstanding loyal listeners and supporters, people that donate to Cap Radio and NSPR. And I bring that up because Cap Radio reporter Kristen Lamb interviewed Nick Bruner, interviewed yourself as well when reporting on these layoffs and cuts. But Nick Bruner was the Modern Music director, had been employed at Cap Radio for 16 years. Listeners knew him as the host of Hey Listen. And he said that he was told the day of last Wednesday that the position was being eliminated. So he didn't have the chance to say goodbye to listeners or local musicians. And I bring that up because we did receive a lot of listener emails and calls and comments. Given that these programs, these four programs, have been on the air for years, and in some cases decades, why not at least give some notice to say goodbye and to explain what's happening?
I think that that's an interesting question, and I'm not going to answer it because we are not in a position to discuss personnel issues. Personnel issues are the privacy between the organization and the people, and it's just not what we're here to do. So if you may notice, I'm not going to answer that question there.
Well, your job is, you're 3 weeks in, is to balance the books, and you've been through this before. You've been part of KPBS in San Diego for 47 years. Have you come across a dire situation like this one at Cap Radio before?
I've had many dire situations in San Diego. We went through, you know, the California recession between 1989 and 1991. Again, when 9/11 and the stock market crash hit in 2001, it was a terrible time. And then again in 2008, when the mortgage crisis and the recession started, this is a challenge for me. This is really deeper than I thought. I don't know exactly what happened. I don't know exactly what caused us. We are about to conduct our annual financial audit. I'm letting the auditors and the powers that be go ahead and look at all the finances very careful. But my job is really right now for us to go forward, for us to move in a positive direction, even though it's been very, very hard on everybody. And we've seen our colleagues and our friends have to leave. But at the end of the day, you know, we're still going to be a $15, $16 million organization with around 70, 75 employees. And I think we're going to do our best to serve the community and try to grow so we can start reaching younger audiences at the same time, not at the expense of as many of our traditional audiences as possible.
Given that Sacramento State holds Cap Radio's license, how is the university helping the station right now?
Well, the university reached out to me because I've had a long relationship with President Wood. He reached out for me. I started talking to the executive committee and the board here for Cap Radio and told them that, you know, my background and what I think I could do to help during this dire time. Sacramento State has come in and really said they're trying to offer as much resources as possible. They are the holder of the license. They are the owner of Cap Radio that have delegated to what I think is an outstanding board that we have here. I don't have the specifics of exactly what they're doing, but their resources from the president's office to the chief financial officer, Jonathan Bowman's work along with Luke Wood and Chief of Staff Mark Wheeler, they are constantly saying, we want Cap Radio to succeed. We don't want to tear it down. And that's why they're coming in trying to help in as many ways as they can.
Tom, thank you for the time.
My pleasure.
Tom Carlo is Cap Radio's interim general manager, discussing the recent layoffs and cuts to music programs in light of Cap Radio's financial challenges. And that is it for Insight today. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Have a nice day. We will catch you right back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.